Good afternoon. So last time, we started talking about distributed systems. And we talked about the two sort of high-level ways that are most common for organizing this, which is the client-server model, where we have servers that are always on, that are contacted by clients with requests from those clients, and then the servers would respond to those requests, versus a peer-to-peer model where everyone can be contacted by anyone. We have to have contact. We have a much more free-form architecture. And in this class, we'll be mostly talking about the server model because, well, it's a lot more common and also a lot simpler. Then we talked about, we want machines to contact each other. We need to know how that's done. So we have this notion of names for machines and addresses for machines. This is a concept we've seen before. We have names for variables and addresses for variables. Same sort of idea here, but with machines. We need to agree between machines on it, and we need to have some way of looking up that information. We saw we had this sort of distributed database called DNS that we used for names of machines on the internet. And it gave us addresses, which turns out were just big numbers. And we use those to actually figure out where messages go in what is called routing. So once we know how to send messages, we want to have abstractions. We don't want to deal with, I want to send this message to this machine. We have this higher level view of this notion of sockets, which are basically two-way pipes to a remote machine, where we specify what machine and via a port number, what program we want to contact. And we got this two-way communication channel, kind of like pipes, but both directions, with the same API, but we have some different functions, some new functions to set that up. In particular, we had this special case for servers. So for servers, we had these server sockets, which weren't like two-way pipes. They're just something we use to create connection sockets, which are the things which are like two-way pipes. Our connection is our two-way communication channel between one server and one client, versus our server sockets are something with a file descriptor that we use to get more file descriptors via the accept call. And we also saw that there is this API that POSIX provided for providing the arguments to all these functions based on names or addresses that might be supplied by our user in a string. We don't have to deal with the details of how IP version 4 and 6 work, that knowing exactly the address is a number, it's stored in this exact way. Instead, there's this function getAdderInfo, where you can just pass, here's the string representing the machine I want to connect to. You figure out what I should be passing to all these functions. So you call that, then you use the results to call the bind, socket, listen, and so on functions in the appropriate way. So any questions on what we covered last time? So, I talked about how we can set up sockets and set up connections. So I'm going to have a few little notes about using sockets. Some things which were true when we talked about read and write for pipes, but are considerably more important for sockets, just generally. And then I'm going to go to a completely different abstraction for remote communication called remote procedure calls. So first, one note is we talked about incomplete reads and writes earlier. With sockets, these become really important because we have lots of reasons why we can have incomplete reads and writes. So the classic thing is, like, I have a connection to a server, then my Wi-Fi goes down. If I'm writing a program and I'd like to know that the Wi-Fi went down while in the middle of me reading something from the server or writing something to a server, I better actually figure out what read and write are returning, or else I won't figure that out. So this is a real reason where we didn't have one before, why read and write can do less than you request. And you have to deal with it. And also for read, well, now if I have a slow connection, it takes my data a long time to get there, so I'm going to do a read, and even though it was all sent at once, well, I might not get it all. I need to deal with that. I need to know, well, I'm not done yet. There's more data. I'm going to need to read again. also, when we're dealing with sockets, sometimes we won't do it for our assignments, but in real code, they'll use what's known as non-blocking modes, where read and write will be set via a call to the special function fcntl for file descriptor control or file control to be non-blocking, meaning that if write would need to wait to do something, like it needs to wait for there to be more space in its buffer, it's just going to say, sorry, I can't write it. And that's actually something you might want for network sockets a lot of the time, because you want to just, you don't want to have your program wait forever if the server goes down, but it goes down in a way where it just stops taking messages without telling you. So you want to handle that explicitly. So this is something that's likely to come up there. So because we can have these incomplete reads and writes, this means that when you're writing code, say for the FTP assignment, you might, you know, you want to do the work to handle, if I have an incomplete write, I can write the whole thing. We will supply some code you can just use which contains functions like this. But this is a common pattern that you'll see because, well, you want to, you know that you've written a little bit of it and handle the error. If you wanted to react to it taking too long, you'd want to handle that here in some way. So that's something you want to handle. The other thing is on reads, we're going to have incomplete reads. So if you want to like read size bytes, you might have to call read a bunch of times because maybe we send 1,000 bytes over the network because that's all that fits in one message in our mailbox model. And then we send the next 1,000 bytes. If your size is like 1,500 bytes, it's going to take two messages to get there. And you'll need to call read twice to get it. So you'll need some loop like this. And where this comes up in protocols like FTP are that, well, in FTP, it's a protocol that looks like text. So I showed you it on the screen, and it looked like text, and it actually is just text. We're just sending text back and forth, which has the advantage of being much easier to debug. The disadvantage of maybe this isn't the most efficient thing to be doing. So to deal with partial reads, you have to note that, well, maybe I sent the command, you know, ls foo, and all that got there was lsf. And you shouldn't run ls of the f file. You want to wait for the new line. And that's something, a little detail you need to handle. And this is a very subtle issue because, well, most of the time, you aren't going to have an incomplete read. You'll get the whole line all at once. Just sometimes you'll get really unlucky and it will get split across two messages just because the sizes worked out in a particular way. And the network was slow enough for you to notice. This is a really nasty bug in servers because it's the sort of thing where the server is broken, but it only shows up like once every month or something like that. Okay, so questions about incomplete reads and writes and handling them? Okay, so some other asides. So I talked about setting up our connections and our sockets with particular addresses. There's a way where once you have one set up, you can query what are its addresses. So one reason this is useful is if I have a client socket where I connect it to a server, if you want to know where am I connecting from, this POSIX call to this getSockName function, that will give you that information. It gives it to you in the form of a sock adder in or sock adder in 6 struct, like the ones I showed earlier, depending on the type of socket you have. So this is how you look up, well, I connected and the system assigned a port number and IP address as my return address for the server. What address did it assign? This is how you can find that out, even though you didn't choose that and therefore wouldn't have any way of knowing what it is. Also, you can look up what's the remote address I'm actually connected to if you want to look that up. And you might say, well, these are nice, but they give me this struct, and that struct is annoying to deal with. I don't want to do that. So, you know, is there some way of printing that out that isn't going to be unreadable and just give me this integer? Who knows what that integer is? And the answer is yes. There's a function called getNameInfo, which is basically the opposite of getAdderInfo. GetAdderInfo takes like a name from a user, like virginia.edu, gives you the information you need to pass to things like bind and connect. This takes the things you would pass to bind and connect, or that you get from getSockName, getPureName, those structs that represent addresses, and converts it into something humans can read, including possibly looking up the host name from the address, if you wanted to. Questions? So before we leave the world of sockets, since our FTP server assignment, which I will add a little bit to and then mark as not tentative, but we're not changing the assignment, I just want to have a few extra hints that the things people ran into last semester. It comes with an example client and server that you are allowed to look at and use. Like, don't claim it's your own code, but comes there because there's a lot of boilerplate code here, like looking up an address, making a connection. There's a whole bunch of calls, and it's not actually interesting. People who do it in the real world, they look up what you do and do that. You know, they're not gonna like read the documentation for connect every time. They're gonna look up an example of how it gets used. So we have this example, echo client and server. By echo, I mean the client connects to the server, it sends something to the server sends back the same thing. That's what this code does. So we have the client side and the server side of that. And it handles a few little details that we didn't talk about explicitly. So one thing is that something POSIX does is when you try to write to a pipe or socket that isn't connected anymore, it kills your process by default, which is what you want if you aren't handling the right failing. But this example code shows you how you can tell the OS not to do that because you have handled the right failing, so it's okay. And it's what a server should do, because it's really annoying if my server goes down every time a client has its Wi-Fi fail while it's connected to my server. It'd be really bad, and we don't want that to happen. Also, something that you might see happening is if you write a server naively, is that you'll run your server, you'll shut it down, and you'll try to run it again, and it will fail to create the server socket. And this is because, by default, the OS reserves the port number for your server after the server exits for a while. The purpose of this is that if a client was trying to connect while the shortly before the server exited, we want to ensure that the client gets a failure. That it doesn't think that it connected to something that's a different server than what it was connecting to. We don't want to avoid confusion about that. And in particular, the nasty case would be the client like did part of the connection, but not all of it, and it like tried to finish the connection after the server exited. So it reserves the port number for a while afterwards. There's an option to turn this off. This code includes that option, which says, yeah, I'm starting a server on the same port. It's okay, it's the same server. Don't worry about it. Or I promise it's at least compatible. Okay, so that's in that code. So questions? So these are things I won't test you on, but they're just practical issues with writing servers, unfortunately. Okay, so we talked about servers. So one brief note is that I showed you code which is what's known as half duplex. That it assumes that we read something or we write something. We never want to do both. But this is not always what you want to do when you're writing code that uses sockets. So for example, if I'm thinking of a chat server, I want to write messages to someone else and always be reading messages from the server that might be coming to me. So I want to read and write at the same time. And this is not something which is obvious how to do with just read and write, because I can't, there's not a read and write call, there's a read call or write call, and I have to be calling one of them. So the easiest solution is to use threads. You can have one thread to read, one thread to write. This way your client can have a thread that's writing the messages you're trying to send while it's reading the messages it gets from the server. The server can have two threads for every connection, one to read messages that are coming in, one to write the messages that it needs to send to the user that came from other users. So another option is that we can use non-blocking I/O, and there are these I/O multiplexing functions like select and pull, which basically you can call them and ask, when can I read and write without waiting? So you call them and you figure out, can I read and write? Tell me the first thing I can do, reading or writing, and it will tell you, oh, first thing you can do is reading, or the first thing you can do is writing, and then you read or write depending on what it returns. Okay, so questions? And this would be with the event loop model we briefly talked about when we talked about threads as an alternative to threads. And you can see here why it would be pretty attractive, because boy, are we using a lot of threads if we're using threads. Okay, so that's everything I have about sockets. So let's start our next topic, which is I want a completely different model. Sockets have all this annoying setup. Then I need to figure out how to turn things into these messages. You know, I mentioned I have to like design these protocols that where we agree on what messages mean. And I'd like something that's more natural to me as a programmer. And one model people came up with is I'm going to write a bunch of functions, and I just want to call them on another machine. So I'm going to write a bunch of functions, and then there's going to be some tool that someone's going to write that's going to handle all the details of making that work. And the details of making that work are that they're going to turn my functions into socket code that handles letting me call them from another machine, both the server and client side of that. We'll look at what that might look like a little later. So this idea is called remote procedure calls. This is a much higher level view and possibly much more useful. And this is also our first introduction to a common thing you'll see when people talk about distributed systems, which is a goal of transparency. By transparency, I mean that you can see through the system being distributed in the sense that it's invisible to you that the system is distributed. So for remote procedure calls, it being transparent means that we should be able to call these functions on another machine the same way we call functions on our local machine, you know, and it's going to be the same code. We as a programmer are never going to have to think about it being on another machine. We just write the code as if it were on the local machine, and then it works across multiple machines, and everything's great. So this is the goal. This is typically what these systems are designed for, and we'll see how close we can get, and how close real systems end up getting. But that's our goal. So to do this, we want to provide the same interface when I'm writing my code. So we want me to have code which is intending to call a local function and it actually calls a remote function. So we need to implement that some way. And the way most RPC systems implement this is they produce something called a stub. And a stub is just going to be a wrapper function that stands in for the other machine. So I'm going to call a function that's going to look exactly like a local call. And in fact, it's going to be a local function call. But I'm not going to call the remote machine. I'm going to call this stub that was written by whatever tool I used to implement remote procedure calls. And that stub is going to handle turning it in to a remote procedure call. On the other end, on the machine where I'm calling where the remote procedure on, where it's going to actually run, there's going to be another stub which is going to handle actually calling the real function and then taking the return value and figuring out how to turn that into returning from the real machine that's calling it. So let's add sort of this in a picture view. So we have our client program, and it makes a normal function call, and this goes to a client stub. So this client stub is typically going to be generated by some compiler-like tool. So as part of using this remote procedure call tool, I'll run something that looks kind of like a compiler. We'll look at what it's compiling later. But it's going to produce this wrapper function called the client stub. And the client stub's going to contain code to do things like take the arguments I supply to it and convert them to bytes. Why bytes? Because that's what the write call in sockets takes. So after it does that, it's going to pass that information to the RPC library, and the RPC library is going to use sockets to contact the RPC library running as probably a server on the other machine. Then on the other machine, the RPC library is going to talk to another stub, but this is not going to be one which takes function calls, it's going to be one which makes function calls. So it's going to get those bytes that were sent over the network, it's going to convert them back into arguments, and it's going to actually make the function call to the server program, and the server program is going to return to the server stub, and it's going to translate that back into bytes. That's going to be sent back over the network, sent back to the client stub, and that's going to be returned from the original function call. So our view from the client is we make a function call, it goes somewhere, we don't care how the function's implemented, but the implementation actually goes to the remote machine and then returns just as usual. And our view from the server is that we get a function call, we don't care where it comes from, we're just implementing this function, we return a value, and this happens to help out this other machine. So questions about this model so far? So something we need to implement this, that we're sending over the network the call, so we need not only the arguments converted to bytes, but we need to have some agreement on the protocol for, like, how do we know what function we're calling? So that's going to be something we're going to have to deal with later. And we need to send back the return value, and we also might need to send back some failure information. We'll talk about that later. So this is sort of the data flow, and let me show you what might this look like. And as I said, our goal is transparency. So we want this to basically look like a normal function call. So here's a hypothetical API. I'll do a real example of like a production, industrial, used by many companies RPC library API later. But this is a simple, possible API that's very similar to that. So here, we call this function to get a context. And the reason I have that here, why I didn't remove that from my example, is, well, we needed a little bit of information to make this call. We need the client to say, where is the server I'm calling? That needs to be supplied somewhere. And the most common way is that we're going to have to call a function to specify, this is where I'm calling it, and then pass that to the function calls we're using. Just so the library knows, where do I actually make this call? You could imagine other ways of doing this, but either way, you know, this is kind of a transparency failure. It's mostly like a function call, but we're not hiding that it's remote anymore. And we kind of have to do that because we need to specify somewhere what the server is. You know, it has to be specified somehow. And on the server side, the server runs a function created by the RPC library, and then it has its implementation of this call that just handles the actual operation. And in this case, the operation is make dir, so I have a way of making a directory on a remote machine. So questions about this model. And something to very briefly note is that I showed you sort of the C-like model. Commonly, you also see the same idea, but with an object-oriented model, which perhaps hides the sort of non-transparency a little better, where instead of having like functions at, in the global namespace, you'll get a class that represents the functions on the remote machine, and you'll call methods of that class, and the server will be implement a subclass of that class. But it's the same idea, it's just that this, you know, here our stubs are methods, they're free functions in the previous model. Okay, so we talked about what this looks like from the client and server side, and we saw that we have these things we call that are stubs, which are generated by our RPC library. So what those stubs do, and what needs to happen under the hood, is something known as marshalling. So we need to send the arguments and the return values over the network. So this is called either marshalling or serialization. And you might say, well, we just have some arguments, just copy those bytes onto the network. And you can't do that. Doesn't work. Well, sometimes works. Doesn't usually work. So one problem is we have things like pointers. If I pass, in this case, a char star to my makedir function, well, probably I don't want to just copy the address of that char star and send it over the network, because it doesn't make any sense on the other machine. It's a different process. It has a different thing at that address. So to actually send it over the network, I need to understand it's a string, you know, and it, you know, it's null terminated. I need to have do something smarter that's aware of the types of the arguments to handle it. Also, we might deal with different architectures. So as we'll talk about a bit more later, is that, you know, we want to not have to think about, is my server using the same type of machine as my client? So maybe I have a 32-bit value that's my long, and the other machine has a 64-bit value that's its long. And we want that to still work, so we have to have agreement on what the size of everything is, which wasn't a concern in a single machine because, well, my C compiler, you know, does the same thing on my machine always, but it doesn't do the same thing on my machine and, you know, like a cell phone necessarily. So we need to, we want that to work, and that's probably part of the point of doing a remote procedure call, is that we have two different machines and they communicate. We need to handle that too. Okay. So we have this marshalling task and these generating all these stubs that needs to be done. I told you it was a compiler-like thing. So we're going to have the information that the tool needs to know. So about the what remote procedures are there, what types should they take in so I can generate that marshalling code. And it's going to be specified by the author of the RPC server, the person who's writing all the functions that can be called remotely, what's called an interface description language, or IDL. And this will be compiled into a bunch of code. That's our stubs and our marshalling and unmarshalling code. So one question you might have is, why did I say we're going to make a completely new language that we're going to compile into this to these stubs? Why don't I just say, here's my header file, these are the functions I want to call remotely, make it work? You know, why are we using this special new language? And this is what, you know, almost all RPC systems do. There's a whole lot of them. They almost all have their own special little language for specifying what the things are. And there's a bunch of reasons for this. So someone think of some reasons why we would do this. What are reasons why we don't just take a header, give you point, have you take a header file and do it? Yeah. Okay, so you're worried about security? So we haven't talked about security. Security is a good concern. And security also didn't show up when I gave my example here. I just said we specify a server name, we're done. And I don't specify, well, how do I know I'm actually supposed to contact that server? So indeed, there's probably going to be some stuff we want to support for security. This is actually not most of the reason for that, because usually we do that as sort of a separate step. But yes, security is a concern, and one that my slides completely gloss over. So, other concerns? Yeah.
It seems like just the header file isn't enough. Like if you had a pointer, okay. You don't know how much it's pointing to.
Okay, yeah, so you say the header file is missing information. Like if I have a pointer, I don't know how much it's pointing to. So, pointer points to what? You know, size. So that's one thing. Any other things? Yeah.
Is it so, like, when it compiles, it doesn't compile to a specific architecture?
Yeah. So another is portability. That if I use a long, I don't want to actually have you specify a long. I want you to specify a 64-bit integer. So when I compile for my, 32-bit ARM processor, I know, no, I really mean a 64-bit integer, not just an integer. Any other concerns? Okay, so these were some of the concerns. I made a long list. So we had so what size of things do pointers point to? We don't know that. So something like C, the header file isn't actually enough to make good serialization code. There's other things. So for example, in C, you might pass a list pointer intending the function to modify it. And well, either, there was one question of, will we support that? And if so, that seems very complicated, because we have to send it both ways as a return value. And also, how do we know if that's happening? So we want that sort of information. And there's some other things that come up. So one is, how does memory get allocated and deallocated? And that's not something that's not in your header file in the code, but it's very important to know, if the function returns a pointer, how is that freed? Yeah, so the header file doesn't contain the right information. And also, sometimes we want to specify something about how the argument and function name is set over the network, and we'll see one reason for this with changing the versions of the functions later. So, and the other reason is portability. And you talked about machine neutrality, that different architectures are going to do different things. We want to have one interface for all of them. And often, RPC systems even have a goal of language neutrality, that I want to write my RPC server in Python and pass things to it from C, have it look like C calls. So often they'll have that goal of not even being specific to a particular language, because you might write your client and server with different types of software, and they just want that to work. Yeah, and another big issue is about versioning incompatibility. So with libraries, we just say, if you don't have the right version of the library, change the version you have. This doesn't work so well with RPC, because if I upgrade my client, when do I upgrade my server? I can't do it in lockstep. My clients and servers are going to have different versions. So something extra information we'll often want is information about how do we deal with if the client is running a more recent version than the server or vice versa. So with these differences in mind, let me go over sort of a high level, very simple idea of what an IDL could look like. So here I specify something I call a protocol, which is the set of things I can call, things I can send to this server. And I have two commands in that protocol, which are my remote procedure calls, makedir and removedir. And you can see I have this int32 type, int32, because I want it to be portable. I'm saying it's always 32 bits, no matter what the size of integers on the machines we're using are. And I have a string type, and it's not char star, because the RPC system really wants to know if it's a fixed size thing or a variable size thing. So they'll typically have a string type so they know, okay, we send the length and the data for this case. And I've also, in this case, as is one common thing RPC systems do, I've labeled each of the functions with a number. And in this case, I'm saying, we're going to use that so when we send it over the network, we're not going to say make dir over the network. We're going to say function 1. And that makes it a more efficient thing over the network. So that's something we want to do. It also lets us rename this function without breaking the protocol if we want to do that. We decide, wait, mkdir is a horrible name. Why did anyone ever use it? Let's use make directory. We can change the name in this file, but this protocol over the sockets are the same, so I don't have to change my clients that use the old name. They're going to not send the name over the network, so it's okay. And the convention I proposed here is that we'll send the function number as 1 byte, because we only need 1 byte, which we can tell by reading this whole file and seeing there's only 2, so we only need 1 byte. Then we'll send the string argument, terminated by a null character, which I assume is safe because it's a string. And the server, after it gets this, it will call the function and it will send back the result just as 4 bytes of an integer. So this is one possible RPC implementation. So any questions about what I've shown here? So this is sort of the nice simplified example. I'm going to go through some real examples, quote unquote, for gRPC, which is an RPC system developed at Google, to show you sort of what happens industrially. You'll see that some things get a bit more complicated. And this is for a deliberate design choice reasons. In particular, you'll find that this looks even less transparent, that there's more stuff going on in this interface that makes it obvious you're calling something on a remote server and things are different. But these are mostly choices that they've made because they feel that it's still more convenient than sort of the socket model. So first I'm going to go through this interface description language that gRPC uses. So here's an example of my same make directory thing with that. So I have a type for the arguments for each of the functions, which is a message. So a message, when I compile this for C++, it's going to turn into a C++ class. So what this interface description language will do for me is not only will it generate the stubs for the functions, but it's going to generate the actual classes for my messages, the things I send as arguments, as part of this. And this is part of being language neutral that makes it attractive to do that. So now I have the same struct for all languages with the same fields. And also the C++ class in this case has the marshalling and unmarshalling code in it. That's built by the library. And actually, Google has this functionality available independently of RPC as something called protocol buffers. And there are other systems like that, which just handle the marshalling and unmarshalling part, turning messages into bytes and letting you access them from C code or whatever language you want. So you notice that each of the fields in these messages have numbers. And when these messages are turned into bytes, those numbers appear in the messages. That's how in the socket, in the sockets when it's just bytes, we identify this is the value for field number 1 is what's sent. We don't send this is the path. We send field number 1 has this value. And the advantage of doing this is that you can change the field names. You can add new fields. You can remove fields with limitations and still have the byte format be compatible. So this is a choice they've made to let them change these messages around a bit more. So then, at the bottom here, we have something that's not a message, but what they call a service, and here's where we define our functions. So we define a function, and when we compile this for C++, it's going to turn this service into a C++ class with these functions as virtual functions. And that's going to be our stubs. and what our implementation is going to use. Our implementation is going to derive from that C++ class and implement those functions, and there's going to be a stub version which derives from the class and has an implementation that sends things over a socket to call the real version on another machine. And you'll notice that they've made this choice that rather than letting you specify multiple arguments, every single function returns exactly one value and takes exactly one value. That's just a choice they made. That's just a message, and it has to be a message. There's not a string. That's why I defined a message that only contains a string. And they made this choice to just make it more consistent. So we don't have functions taking ints. They always take a message, just so we only write the code to handle functions taking messages. And also because they think you might want to add arguments later on, and this makes it easier. So questions so far? Okay, so once we have this IDL, we compile it to something, and then we make our implementation. And as I said, all our things turn into methods of a C++ class, so we have a version of the C++ class I use at the server, where I just derive from this class the RPC library generates for me, and I just implement the method. And like we saw before, we have a context that's passed in. This is to handle anything we need to query about the client. Here, there's nothing like that. Also, note that in this case, Google has chosen to have them pass in pointers to our arguments and our return value. So we return a status, but to actually set the result return value, we have a pointer to change that. And to get our arguments, there's a pointer we get in, and the memory is allocated by the RPC library for us and deallocated by the RPC library. So in this case, I do the actual make directory call with the operating system and then return either it failed, and here's my error message in this status object, or I return it went good. And that's how the client gets back the result. For my list directory method, I have the same procedure, but I have to return a value. And the way I return a value is not by using return, but instead, they've chosen that I always just get a pointer and I just modify that pointer. So questions here. This is our, so it's just, but it's basically, we have these slightly less elegant prototypes than you might like. It's not like probably the interface you would have designed if you were only doing this, but we just implement these methods in our own subclass, and that's our server. That's our implementation of them. And then to use this server, we use some functions in the RPC library where we specify, here's my implementation class, here's an instance of it with all the methods implemented on it, and I'm just going to tell you, I want you to use this port number and host name, and then I say, and I pass the service I want you to run, and then I just say, let's start the server, and that's it. And the RPC library handles reading from connections to that port and running our methods as clients ask for it. And on the client side, the client creates what they call a channel. Just say, I want to connect to the server. It also specifies, so there is security here. So you mentioned security. It shows up here in that we specify there's no credentials. Credentials mean login. Here I'm just not using logins, but they support that. And then we say, okay, create a stub for this server. So I specify, hey, I'd like to connect to this port number and IP address. And then I say, here's my stub called stub that I'm creating from that. And that gives us methods we can call that actually send a message to that port number and run the method we chose. So here I have my make directory arguments, I set the name I'm passing, and then I call make directory as if it were like a local method with the same prototype, and I get back the status, but it actually goes over the network. Or similarly, I can call a method where I have my list of values that's returned, but it doesn't actually get returned. Instead, I pass a pointer to the list I want changed in, and I look at that pointer afterwards. The RPC library will change it based on what the server returns. Okay, so questions you see here? Okay, so I'm not gonna test you on the specifics of the Google RPC library, but I want you to see, well, maybe it's not so elegant in the quote-unquote real world. That we have a bunch of setup, we have to deal with the server and the port number, we have to specify things about security and credentials, because in the real world that came up, we cared about that. We have to deal with errors, so I had to get the status from my make directory, because it might fail, and that error could have been that the, or this should have been list directory, wow. From my list directory, because it might have failed, even though that may be, you know, less possible. Also, we have to deal with server and clients being out of sync. And I'll talk about what happens in the case of the Google RPC library if the server and clients are out of sync in a bit. And the other big source of non-transparency, which we kind of glossed over, is performance. So the performance of this is going to be way worse than the local performance. So let's first talk about our errors. So there's different errors we might have, some of which aren't possible on a local machine. So in a local machine, yeah, you expect make error is going to fail sometimes, like permission denied. But we have other ways it can fail. So one way it could fail is I called the server and the server doesn't actually have the make error method because it's an older version. Or another way it could fail is I called the server and I didn't get a response after a minute. And I'm just assuming the server's broken, but maybe it worked. And these are all things we kind of need to consider if we actually, you know, care about whether the directory was made. So that's about errors. So on performance, if we think about our performance, so for a local procedure call, how fast is a local procedure call? Like, tell me, like, what number? How many seconds, microseconds, should that take? No guesses. Cycles?
20 milliseconds.
What?
20 milliseconds.
20 milliseconds? You're saying for a local procedure call? So someone says, yeah.
Less than a millisecond.
Less than a millisecond? Okay. Anyone want to give a more precise estimate?
100 microseconds.
100 microseconds. Okay. That's your guesses. So, what is a local procedure call? What do we have to do for a local procedure call? This is architecture / 2150 call stack review. Yeah.
Push and jump.
So push, jump, like something like that. So this is like two instructions. It's like order two clock cycles. So these estimates are a little high. There's also like a return and like, you know, as moving to the return address. So like maybe it's more like, you know, 10 clock cycles, which on a modern processor is like, you know, 3 nanoseconds. Okay. Maybe a bit slower if we have more arguments and things like that, and because we have branch mispredictions. So, you know, but it's nanoseconds. A remote procedure call, well, it depends on your network, but it's like microseconds to milliseconds. way slower. Okay. So the performance, very different. Okay. So that's on performance. So, concurrency, and being out of sync, we'll talk about later. So talk about these errors. So one thing about dealing with errors is when we think about sequences of a remote procedure calls. So here I have, let's say I have an open call. So I get an open, a file descriptor, a remote file descriptor for my open. You know, I'm just implementing, or file handle in this case, for my open. You know, I'm implementing something like fopen, but it's on a remote machine. Seems useful. And I just say, okay, I'm gonna write, here's my remote print, and then I close. So what happens if the client crashes here? Then there's a question about what does the server do about that? Does the server doesn't get any function calls, it just has this file open on behalf of the client that is tracking. And it doesn't know when it can get rid of it. Maybe the client lost power. Maybe the client was rebooted. But the server doesn't know that. So this is a tricky issue, and one we'll talk about either later today or probably next time. Yeah. So this is something that we have to think about when we're using even remote procedure calls, where we can't really hide that it's remote anymore, because we want a good solution to this problem, one that doesn't involve our server having more and more and more files open as clients slowly like get rebooted while they're in the middle of something or something like that. You know, once every week or something like that, and keep running the server for a year, and eventually we're out of memory. The other issue was on versioning. And in normal software, you know, with local procedure calls, well, you just have two copies of the library, one which is version 1, one which is version 2. And you just link against the right one. If there's a problem, your linker will say, hey, that function doesn't exist. What are you doing? And that doesn't work with RPC because we have these out-of-sync upgrades. So we saw that messages had field numbers for Google's RPC system. That's how they dealt with versioning. And the way this works is that they say you can add new fields to messages if you mark them as optional. And you can also, in fact, remove fields that are marked as optional. And the rule is that if they're optional, we'll assume if they're missing, it's okay. We just see a message with a field number we don't understand. We're just going to ignore that field, give you the rest of the message. And you, as the RPC server author, are responsible for making sure it makes sense what you mark as optional and what you add and remove. And if you want to like change a message that shouldn't be optional, well, what Google RPC says is you make a new method. So you have two versions of the method, and you keep them both around as long as you need to. An alternate solution you might see is that you'll have a whole version for the whole service. So you have like two Directory Protocol V1 class and a Directory Protocol V2 class, and you'll just, you know, if you want your server to support both, you'll implement both of those classes. And the client will use a particular one. Okay, and I talked about performance. So something I note about RPC is I talked about RPC about contacting remote machines, but people often use it locally. It's actually convenient as a local way of communicating between two processes. Like, it's a lot more convenient to write code that does useful stuff with remote procedure calls than it is with pipes. So people do use it locally, and if you care about making it fast locally, you don't need to use pipes or sockets. You can use shared memory and mutexes and condition variables. And some RPC systems will do that. So questions on remote procedure calls. Just stop on this slide. Yeah?
So how is this different than just making an HTTP call, expecting some code to run on some HTTP server?
So the question is, how is this different than making an HTTP call and expecting some code to run? Well, it's not very different. The main difference is that we have a particular way of specifying what are the arguments being run, what do we expect to be returned, and so on, dealing with problems like versioning and so on. And as far as like the example of HTTP, well, if you were like carefully looking at this slide, I mentioned that, well, gRPC, in fact, is messages over HTTP. That is how it is implemented. It's just a particular convention about what do those messages contain. You know, what HTTP requests do we make, and what response do we expect? And a particular way of using it from normal programs, you know, rather than writing the actual bytes out. Okay. Other questions? Yeah. So the question is, it seems like this isn't for browsers. Indeed, it is typically not what you would use in browsers. Okay. And in fact, our next topic will be an example actual use case of this, which is going to be network file systems. So one example. So if you've used an account on one of the department machines, like portal.csnow or LabUnit, the lab machines before, like you had your files were always there. You could log into multiple machines, SSH into multiple different servers. They're always there, even though it's several machines. And these are physically separate machines. How do we make that work? Well, we didn't have all the machines hooked up to the same disk. We instead had one machine hooked up to one disk, and it act as a server that the other machines contacted. So this was an example of a distributed system that all these machines work together to supply you access to these files and let you use them everywhere. And this server is known as a network file server. So the file system is backed by a remote machine. And maybe the simplest way you could imagine implementing a network file server is that we just set it up so you make your normal system calls, like open, read, and write, and on whatever machine you're logging into, you SSH into the department machines, you make those normal system calls, and it realizes, oh, you're trying to access stuff on the remote machine, I'm going to just turn those into remote procedure calls instead of local procedure calls to access the file system. See, that's an example, nice application. So you just churn the system calls into remote procedure calls. Maybe you say that's a little unrealistic, but remember we talked about this sort of abstraction like the virtual file system layer in Linux, where if you were writing a file system, you'd implement these particular functions. So probably those calls are what we churn into remote procedure calls. It would just be the same way as if we had, FAT and extended 2. We just have this new type of file system, and all its calls are, in fact, remote procedure calls. And this is a nice idea. And in fact, from a high level, this idea is the basis of one of the most common network file systems out there, known as NFS, for network file system, because Sun Microsystems, when they made this, was not very creative. But this naive approach has some problems, so we're going to need to do some refinement. So one issue is what the server needs to store. The server's going to need to keep track of stuff, and it turns out this is going to be problematic. And it's going to be problematic because, well, what if the server or the client crashes? And this is something we need to think about because, well, that's going to happen, and we want to know at least, maybe our solution isn't elegant, but what's it going to be? How are we going to make sure that if the server or client crashes, we can recover eventually somehow? Get things to an okay state. And there's another issue, which is performance. We'll talk a bunch about performance, probably not this class. So let's start with the state. So with this model, where we just take every system call and turn it into a remote procedure call, the server, well, it probably needs to keep track of open file descriptors for every single client, every single process running on every single client that's using this shared network file system, and the current working directory. So even when everything goes great, this is actually not very nice. And it's not very nice because if you think of having, like, you know, 20 machines running like 1,000 processes each for all our users here, this gets pretty expensive pretty quickly. We're tracking, you know, easily 1 million file descriptors. So we'd prefer to avoid doing that, but it's viable at least. It will work. Just means our server needs to be pretty beefy. Then we have the question of, well, if we're tracking this information, what happens if the client crashes? And a nasty thing about this is the server is not going to get a message saying, the client crashed, typically. Instead, the server is going to say, gosh, that client hasn't been doing anything for 10 minutes. I wonder if it's still running. And you don't know. Like, maybe someone just unplugged the network cable, and they're going to plug it back in 2 minutes. Or maybe they unplugged the power cable, and it's never coming back. And the server has no way of knowing this. And the server would really like to eventually delete that open file information. Because if it doesn't do that, we keep this running all semester. You know, we have server lose power a couple times. Suddenly, we are, like, wasting tons of memory. Okay. That's if a client crashes. Then we have the issue of what if the server crashes? Well, we restart it, obviously. Like, the server's down, it loses power, you know, something fails, we repair it, restart it, or we start a new server connected to the same disks, or restore from backup. Okay, then what do the clients do? And our answer so far is that basically, well, the clients don't actually have this information stored locally. They don't know what file exactly each file descriptor is because they just passed the open call and got a file descriptor. They don't know where in the file they are. They just passed the read calls and the offset changed. So the clients don't actually have the ability to restore this information and probably would need to restart. So let's start with this. So is there something way we could do make this work better? Is there some improvement we can make where we change things so the server crashing is not we restart every single machine in the building? Which clearly seems like really bad. And note that another reason why this is a concern is maybe the server is restarted not because it crashed, but because we went to upgrade it. You know, our upgrade story now is restart every single machine in the building to upgrade this one machine. So what would be an alternative? Yeah. Okay, so client, yeah, tracks more info. So we can have the client track enough information, and that's going to be our main solution, NFS's solution to this problem, is that the client's going to track more information, and that's also going to help with this problem. So we're going to say that, you know, eventually we're going to arrive at saying, maybe the server shouldn't store this information, maybe it's better for the client too, but we need to figure out a way of doing that. So another issue that we have is performance. So even when everything's working normally, you know, we're used to, well, I read and write files, and I'm actually reading and writing local memory. It's nice and fast because I have this page cache, which I spent a lot of effort implementing and making sure it has all the things we're accessing frequently in it. Even did these tricks like read ahead and making sure that we get things in there early. And this means that my reads and writes and so on are going to take microseconds. You know, open the file, it's cached. I just, you know, get it from memory. I don't actually go to the disk. It doesn't matter if the disk takes milliseconds because it's cached probably. You know, I'm caught reading from the file. It's already in memory. Like, even if I only read the first part, we did read ahead. It's already there. Don't need to do anything. But now with our network file system, these are all slower, because if I open the file, I have to say, hey, server, my client wants to open foo.txt. Does that even exist? You have to wait for that response. I want to read from the file. I have to get it from the server. So can we do better than this? Can we avoid that? And, no. Can we avoid this, that just takes a millisecond or two to contact the server? Someone have a partial solution? So we'll get to this later. So we're going to want to avoid contacting the server is the key idea. Like, we have whatever a solution is, it can't mean that every time we open and read, we contact the server, or else, well, we're going to pay that cost. We're going to have some solutions for that. So first, I'm going to talk about an explicit example of something which does a little bit better. So it's going to solve some of the problems I just talked about. And this is the network file system version 2. And you can read all about it in RFC 1094, but I'll just give you a high-level overview, which is what we care about for this class. And it's based on RPC calls. And here's a subset of what the remote procedure calls are and their arguments. So one thing to notice is we have a bunch of file IDs. So they made the choice that when we identify a file, we're not going to use a path name. Instead, we're going to use this opaque number that the server sends to the clients. And this is part of solving that problem we mentioned earlier of the server not keeping track of as much information. So this opaque data is going to be device and IDO number, typically, plus something called a generation number, which we'll talk about later. And the idea about something like this is that now, given a file, I know exactly where to get to it. So this is partly a performance optimization, that when I'm doing a read, I don't need to look up what the file is in a table. I don't need to store all the open file descriptors for each client. Instead, the client tells me, this is the exact file I'm reading. I don't even need the file name. Here's just the identifier for the file, which tells you exactly where it is on disk, because you know it's this IDO number. And that's what I want to read. And so this means that the client is going to track the mapping from file descriptor to file ID, so the server doesn't need to keep track of that per client information. So everything in our file ID is just something which doesn't depend on what the client was doing. It's just what files are they accessing. So our clients will have a map for each of their file descriptors. They'll track, this is the server I go to, and this is the file ID I pass to the server. And that file ID contains everything the server needs to know to find that file. If a client crashes, well, its mapping is automatically deleted. Why automatically? Because it's on the same machine that crashed. And that means that we've solved the problem of keeping track of the state by having the client do it. And note that what we're keeping here as the file ID is something the server can convert directly to a file on disk. It doesn't need another table. It doesn't need to keep track of information about the client. It just knows when it gets each request from a client, what file it is from the request alone. It doesn't need to remember about the previous opens and so on. So this is a choice they made so the server keeps track of less state, and it also deals with the problems of clients crashing. When a client crashes, well, it's okay. We don't have anything we're keeping track of in the server. We're not going to leak memory because of it. So questions so far? So we have these file IDs. And the typical choice, as I said, is this device, meaning which disk is it on, where's the file system, and the IDO number in the file system. And this generation number. So the generation number, that's a confusing thing. Why do we need more information? So something we're doing here is, because the server doesn't know which files a client is using, it only knows that the client just tried to read or look up a file, it doesn't get to know what files the client has open. When a client opens a file, what it's going to do is it's going to look up the file ID, and that's it. Maybe it's also going to look up its attributes to see if it's supposed to be able to open it, but that's it. It's not going to actually do anything else. It's not going to change anything on the server. So the server is only going to know later on the client tries to read the file. And a problem we have is, what happens if a client has a file open, it gets its file ID, and then the file's removed, or renamed, or moved around? Most notably, if it's removed, maybe that INode number gets reused for a completely different file. And we don't want the client to accidentally read from the wrong file. That would be a problem with our approach. Because we don't know what clients have a file open, we can't actually react directly to removing a file that they have open. We can't do anything about that until the client actually tries to use that file it still has open. So what NFS has chosen to do is that it keeps track of the generation number, which is incremented every time we delete a file and reuse that inode. And the idea of this is that we'll store this in the inode itself. Well, it'd be another field in the inode. So this is a change we're making to our normal file system just to support network file systems. And the server will use this to say, oh, you're trying to read from that file, I'm sorry it went away, rather than giving you the wrong data. So, questions? So, with these file IDs, you'll notice that we've tried very hard to have what we call a stateless protocol. So the server is not keeping track of any information about the clients whatsoever. Doesn't need know what clients have it open, even though that means we need to go through these little hoops to handle what if something happens to a file a client has open. And each of these operations, because it's a stateless protocol, stands alone. That a server can handle a write to a file without knowing what happened before and after the write. It just knows, there's the write, here's a file ID, I find that on disk, I write to it, I'm done. There's no open, there's no looking up a file descriptor. It's just one operation that it can just do by itself. And this property is what lets us deal elegantly with client failures. And also, if we think about it, it deals elegantly with server failures. When we have a server failing, well, if the server comes back up with the same file system, the clients can just keep going as if nothing happened. So we've handled those failures by using this stateless protocol. And so there's some other things we might need to do to deal with the statelessness. So one issue is, what about things like reading a directory? So when I read a directory, I read a few files. I'm not going to read all of them all at once, most likely, for like a directory with 10,000 files. So their solution, and this is the general pattern we see, is that you pass this cookie, as they call it, which tells you where in the directory you are. And when you call reader, you get a bunch of files and names and a cookie to pass to the next call. And this is just some opaque data which tells the server, where do I start next? And the idea is that the client stores opaque tokens like file IDs and cookies. It doesn't know what they mean, but what it's actually doing is it's storing stuff that the server would otherwise have to store. So the file IDs are what the client stores instead of the server tracking file descriptors. And this cookie is what the client stores instead of the server tracking what offset are you at in the directory. Instead, the client stores this thing for the server. It doesn't know what it is. It doesn't care. It just passes it back to the server. It's storing it on its behalf. And this is a really useful pattern, something you'll see all over the place, for taking a stateful service and turning it into something you can use in a stateless way. If you know the web, like the web uses cookies with the same name, with the same idea, that the client stores something on behalf of the server to remember it for them. And NFS is using this with file IDs and offset in the directory sort of information. The client doesn't know how to interpret that information, it just passes it back to the server later on, so the server doesn't need to remember anything. Okay, so that's where I'll finish up today. So any questions before I'm done? Okay, so next time we'll talk about the one big issue we didn't talk about, which is performance, and how we make that okay. And how, because performance, it turns out, with what we've shown so far, not so great. So we'll try to fix that.